Before I come to my subject matter, I'd like to tell you about some of the prophecies that our great writers made concerning the future of Russia. I would even say maybe the world. Maybe many of you have heard, or some have read, the great works of a contemporary of my father, Dostoevsky, who in his youth was carried away by revolutionary ideas. He was even in exile, but later on he came to the belief in Christ, and he understood that in the movement of that time in Russia, there was nothing that he could really take in that would give him something for his mind and soul. He wrote a great many books, and one of the greatest books he wrote was The Possessed, or The Satans. In Russian, it's Bessie. In this book, Dostoevsky gives us a very clear picture of a type of a revolutionary, of the ideas of a revolutionary. One of his heroes, in speaking about a future type of this revolution, he speaks about his ideas and he says, well, what must we do? First of all, we must kill in the people all desire for family life, for love. We must corrupt people, intoxicate them. We must destroy geniuses in their very childhood. We must bring the people to one denominator. And then what happens? Then happens what has happened in Russia. When people have no more will, no more power, no freedom, nothing. Like robots. And Tolstoy was also afraid of the revolution, though maybe you heard that Tolstoy was always a defender of the working class, of the poor people. He wrote many books about the situation of the workers and the peasants. He approached the government several times. He approached the Duma, which was the parliament at that time in Russia, trying to bring in at least a constitutional government where the rights of the people would be defended, where more freedom would be given. He didn't believe in the revolutionary movement, the same as Dostoevsky did not. He did not believe in force and violence. And he did not believe that by means of force and violence, you could make the happiness of the people. He said, the Tsarist government is holding the power by force and violence. The new government is trying, the revolutionaries are trying to seize the power by force and violence. But he said, nothing good will come out of it. It might be even worse. Because the old thief, the family of the Romanov, of the Tsar, has already made his pile and will not be stealing quite so dreadfully as the new one when he comes in. He meant the revolutionaries. Well, he wrote to the Tsar, and in this letter to the Tsar, written, I think, in 1904 or 1905, he wrote to the Tsar warning him that if freedom would not be given to the people, a terrific revolution would break out in Russia. And these words sound nowadays like a prophecy. Well, the so-called communists or socialists or Bolsheviks, whatever you want to call them, did seize the power. They did not want a coalition between the other revolutionaries, between the socialist revolutionaries, another party, socialist Democrats, Mensheviks, the party of the minimum, but they seized the power and they ruled since 1917 alone, without letting any other party come into power or into the government. It might be said that perhaps this happened because Russia was not happy before. Russia was waiting for changes. And the people who were half illiterate, for they were 45% illiterate when the revolution broke out, they were hoping for the best. And when the Bolsheviks proclaimed their slogans, the factories to the workers, the land to the farmers, it was such a temptation to join that party that would give them a new life. The system of getting the power of the Bolsheviks is always the same. At first they promise everything, and then gradually they begin to enslave those people, and what they have promised they never give. Now we see the same picture happening in China, where the landowners are deprived of their lands and everything is given away to the poor. And the Chinese poor people are happy and they do not know what is awaiting them in the future. But never did the Bolsheviks conceal their final aim. That aim was the world revolution, getting to world power. And many people just forget it. Forget that they have this aim, close their eyes to it, and do not see in what a danger the whole world is at the present moment, when half of Europe is in the hands of the so-called communists. When some of the countries in Europe are not yet quite stable, like Italy, Greece, France, when nearly all of China is invaded. Now next, maybe, comes India, Persia, we don't know. Anyway, this danger is facing us, and we cannot talk enough about it, we cannot think about it enough. We must oppose this danger. If there is any danger for this country, we must do all our efforts to try and save this country. The world, all the eyes of the world are looking at the United States for salvation. Well, we see many strikes in this country. We see a lot of propaganda. We see that a great many fields have the so-called Reds who have a great influence in those fields. Especially the strikes, if some of them are on economical basis, I would say, well, then it is all right. But when we remember the words of Lenin who said, that the first step to revolution are strikes, then it seems that we have again to be on our guard and watch out. The day I was asked by one of our students, what do I think? If communism ought to be studied, I answered them. I think I should say that Marxism, socialism, yes, it must be studied because we must know what it is. And when we speak about Marxism, we cannot say that everything is wrong in socialism. I'm not a socialist myself. I will never become one. But there are many people who see the privileges of socialism. But when we speak about Russia being a socialistic government, here lies the enormous mistake. I don't see any socialism in Russia. If you have read The Capital of Karl Marx, you will remember that one of the main principles of Karl Marx and Marxism is the power of the majority over the minority. We don't see that in countries ruled by the Soviets. Is there communism in Soviet Russia? No. And it sounds so strange that they call themselves communists. Why? Christ taught us to be communists, to live in one commune like brothers and sisters. But where do you see communism in Soviet Russia? It just reminds me, when I was in Russia, we had two newspapers, official, of course, governmental newspapers, that has no truth in it. Well, I would say that the socialism and communism of Russia is a socialism that has no socialism in it, and communism that has no communism in it. I once heard a very big socialist, and he belonged to a nation that had a right to hate Nazism more than anybody. He was a Jewish professor, a great friend of mine. We talked from one platform, and he once said, communism or Bolshevism gave birth to Nazism. Well, I would say that if they're not brothers, they're cousins, certainly. And we see gradually how relief, education, welfare, cooperatives, labor, everything a year ago at least was poisoned by the influence of the Soviet agents. Those pinks, the fellow travelers, who enjoy freedom in this country, at the same time are undermining the ways of living of our democratic country by spreading this false propaganda. And, as I repeat, they must understand now, at least, what is the so-called socialism in Russia. They see it every day. They read it in newspapers. They know what is going on because even though those countries are behind the Iron Curtain, all the time news is leaking in through many people. And still, there are people who are prophesizing and trying to, as I say, undermining our country by this false propaganda, those false prophets that go around and speak about the great achievements of Soviet Russia. When this propaganda is going on, it always seems to me, why can't those cultured people understand that this is not progress? When they're speaking about the freedom of Soviet Russia, how can they not understand that that is an enormous lie which is presented to the world and that has hypnotized for a few years also the people of this great country? It is not progress, it's regress. It's not going up, it's going down. As the other day I was walking in New York and I saw a man, he was drunk. And he was trying to climb an escalator that was going down. Well, he went up once and he missed it, and the second time and the third time, you know, like those drunken men, they get mad once in a while. So he went up with a jerk and down he fell. Well, that's exactly what's going to happen to people who think that they are raising the minds and souls of people and are yet going down. One of those fellow travelers I met in my homeland when I was there, for I stayed with the Soviets for 12 years. I was imprisoned for 5 times. I stayed in prison 8 months, not very long. And then finally I succeeded in coming to your great country. Well, I met this woman when she came to Yasnaya Polyana, my father's home. She was exceedingly enthusiastic about all the experiment of the Soviets. And she was really a picture, because in that misery, in the poverty of the village, she certainly was very noticed. When she came and walked through the village, she had a great big fur coat on and a glowing red scarf floating in the wind. And all the village children just ran after her. She was Anna Louise Strong. And not long ago, I suppose you all remember, that Anna Louise Strong was sent out of Russia because she was suspected of being a Soviet spy. Now, I know that she was a great defender of the Soviet regime, and she certainly was not a spy. She was one of those persons who was carried away, and she didn't see. She was blind. She didn't see what she saw, really. Well, this type of persons also exist, who are fanatics, and they really believe in what does not exist. It seems to me that we have come to a point when humanity cannot live without truth. And we must not listen anymore to those specially trained people who go around and try to entangle the minds of people, building up whole theories, trying, as some people I heard, that there is a theory that you can prove that 2 by 2 makes 5. Well, to me it is obvious that we have come to a point when democracy cannot live side by side with dictatorship. Religion cannot live side by side by atheism. And free enterprise, creative minds, creation cannot live side by side with slave labor. The world has become so small. We just take a plane and in a day, in 24 hours, we are in Europe. And now that the world is so small, we must get closer together. And it is impossible for us to live side by side with those countries that really have slavery. Many honest socialists that I know have opposed the communists. They have written against them. And one of the disciples of Karl Marx, Kautsky, has written many pamphlets and books against Bolsheviks, where he writes that the Bolsheviks ridicule democracy, freedom, and equality. They demand freedom as well as special political privileges only for themselves. And in practice, the dictatorship is the most bitter caricature of freedom and democracy. It is said now by the followers of Stalin that in the constitution of Stalin, he has given a lot of privileges. Religion is free in Soviet Russia. Well, they have elected a patriarch. Some of the churches have been reopened. That was during the war. That was done to raise the patriotic feeling of the people, to make the clergyman with the cross bless those people to go and fight for their mother country. It had a great effect on the Russian people. The Russian people were happy to have their churches open. On the other hand, until the churches were permitted, there was another religion that exists at the present moment. That's the religion that exists underground. And it existed from the first day of the revolution. Friends, when we read about the Mensente trial, that Catholic cardinal who was, I'm sure, tried and may be tortured. I recalled the figure of the Soviets themselves, that 120,000 Russian priests, deacons, what they called the servants of the cult, were executed and died in exile at northern camps of Russia. 120,000. Well, I would say that I'm going to try to bring you some pictures of Soviet Russia, but I am sure that if I were to speak 10 times better than I do, you would still, your imagination couldn't give you the full picture of what is going on in Russia. And when some of my Soviet friends listened to me at my lectures, they said, "Mr. Tolstoy, you haven't said one-tenth of what is going on." I said, "I know it, but even one-tenth if I say it, I'm afraid people will have difficulty in believing me." But people like Kasenkina teacher, who jumped from the window of the consulate, she knew. This was the reason when she came to my office that she was trembling all over, and she begged me to give her refuge. And the funny thing was that when she came in, the other teacher, Samarin, with the one who has a family and the twins and a nice daughter of 13, he came in. But when he knew that the Russian teacher from the consulate, Kasenkina, was there, he was so scared. And Kasenkina was scared. They didn't want to meet each other because they were afraid that one of them would denounce the other. Well, those people knew. They knew because even in New York, they lived behind the Iron Curtain. Samarin and Kasenkina told me how they couldn't walk around in Moscow. And Samarin is very fond of music. And he went once to a shop to buy some records. Nobody followed him. He didn't see anybody. But when he came back to the consulate, one of the girls there said, "Comrade Samarin, you went to a musical shop today." "Yes." "Well, you bought some records. You are very fond of Tchaikovsky, aren't you?" That spy even knew the records that man had bought in the store. That's how those people, this is how they were followed, right there in the middle of Manhattan. And Kasenkina very well knew that when she was not allowed to move from her seclusion there in the consulate, that they would have taken her back to Russia, and maybe she would be sent to the northern camps of Russia, maybe killed, executed, or tortured to death. They knew the life they had to live in Russia. And every Soviet person coming there is so happy to be in this country. It seems to him that he has come to heaven. Why? Well, because the standards of living, after more than 30 years of revolution, you would think that the standards of living of the working class would improve. On the contrary, I must say, in full faith, tell you the truth, that I think that the conditions of the working class are worse than they were during the Tsarist regime. The standard of living was low, the wages were low, but first of all, a worker was free. If he wanted to live in Moscow, he could live in Moscow. If he wanted to go to Petersburg or Kharkov or Kyiv, he was free to do so. Now, a worker is tied up to his factory. He cannot move without the permission of his bosses or the party members. How do they live? Well, sometimes there are 8 rooms in an apartment or 6 rooms, and exactly 8 families in 8 rooms, or 6 families in 6 rooms. A family has 1 room, sometimes privileged workers have 2. And imagine yourself, maybe 6 or 8 women cooking at one stove. What can he buy? Well, if he works a month, he scarcely can buy himself a pair of shoes. And if he works 4 months, he can buy himself an overcoat. Nothing more. No bread, no butter, nothing for his family, nothing to eat. That's all he can buy. And for that, he has to stand maybe for hours and hours in line. Now think if Kasienkin and Sabarin, those two teachers, would come to Moscow with all the splendid things they had bought here. And the people of Russia would ask them, Mrs. Kasienkina, could you buy those things free in America? Why, certainly, she would say. And not stand in line? No. And how much did you pay? Well, she would say, I paid so many dollars. Well, how many dollars did you receive? Well, I received $300 per month. This is news leaking behind the Iron Curtain. News that they don't want to have, because when I was in Russia, we read that in America, there were people starving right in the middle of the streets. That's what they want the people to believe. And the life of those farmers, of the peasants, they were very poor before, very poor. And their huts, the small room with those big stoves, had maybe one room, two rooms sometimes. But if a farmer would raise wheat or potatoes or eggs, he could go to the market and sell his produce. At the present moment, no. In those collective farms, which are the granaries of the sort of granaries like factories, where the Soviets give them tractors and machinery and tools, they're supervised by communists. And what a peasant raises, he gets some of it, very little, just enough to feed his family. All the rest goes to the government. What is the price of the produce? If a peasant receives from the Soviet government 10 kopecks for a pound of wheat, the same wheat in the form of bread is sold to the consumer in the cities for 1 ruble, tenfold or 1,000% profit by the government from the working people. And then the communists speak about United States being a capitalistic country. Well, also, the peasants are just in the same situation as the workers. They have brought in passports. And a peasant, if he wants to go to a city and earn more money, he cannot go. Because to go to a city, he has to have a passport. And if he goes without one, then he is considered to be illegally in the city. And he might be arrested any time and sent back or sent to prison. People are afraid to talk. Supposing two friends meet in the street, they're afraid to speak freely. And if they want to speak about something which interests them, about the government or the politics, they always invent some kind of a subject matter that is not important, speaking about theater, music, or their family. Because anytime anybody can be arrested, and if they are arrested, they are asked, what did you speak about? And if they say that they have spoken about different subject matters, both of them will be punished. So they have to just agree upon the subject matter that they were speaking about. Well, there is an anecdote now that they told me in New York, maybe it's a true story, I don't know. But there was a certain Mr. Jones who was very carried away. He was not Mr. Jones, I'm just taking a family name. He had a Russian name. Well, he was carried away by the Soviet regime and all this marvelous experiment. He decided to go and see all the countries under the rule of the Soviets. So he started with Poland. And in about a week's time, his friends got a telegram. Greetings from liberated Warsaw. Next, he went to Czechoslovakia, and they received the telegrams. Greetings from liberated Prague. The next one was from Yugoslavia, Belgrade. The same thing, greetings from liberated Belgrade. Then Mr. Jones disappeared, and nobody knew where he was. Months passed, no Mr. Jones, no news, nothing. And then suddenly, in about 6 or 7 months, another telegram came. Paris, France, greetings from liberated Mr. Jones. Now I am coming to the most sad picture of Russia. Have you heard, friends, about saboteurs in Russia? Engineers, technicians, people who on purpose are ruining the factories. Well, that's what the Soviets say. Now, if something goes wrong at a factory, it isn't the party member who is at the head who is to be blamed. No. It's always the technician or always the engineer. And then this man is given to the Court of Justice trial. And usually, finally, they all admit their guilt. You have noticed that. You have read about it. There is nobody who is tried in Soviet Russia, practically nobody, who finally does not admit that he is guilty. Why is that? Well, if we take the most terrible tortures that world has seen, they cannot be compared to what is going on in Russia. I was tortured in prison. But that was nothing. I remember a day when we were all in prison and we had a great feast in the morning. They brought us herrings, very salted herrings. And then all the prison didn't have any water all day long. We knocked at the door and asked, water, water. No water came. Well, that was a tiny little bit of a torture, nothing to speak about. But those saboteurs really go through such tortures that you can imagine. For example, one of the things that they are doing, they have a bright light, so bright that your eyes can't stand it. Then they began their inquest, and they asked the man for an hour, 2, 12 hours, 24 hours. And the judges are changed, but the victim is there all the time, standing on his feet. Well, there was a man who was imprisoned in the prison of NVD, that's in Moscow. Suddenly a man walked in, an engineer. Finally they got to be friends, and that engineer told the other one his story. His wife died. He had two children, one a little boy who had infantile paralysis, and an older girl, and they lived like one. They were so friendly, and the eldest girl took care of that sick boy while the father was working at the factory. Then he was accused of being a saboteur and put to prison. Well, he was taken to inquest, and he was held 12 hours with that lamp burning, standing on his feet. He came back very exhausted, but he told his friend, he said, I will not admit that I'm guilty. I am not guilty, and I will not say I am. Second time, he stood 24 hours before this lamp. When he came back, he threw himself on the bed. He couldn't speak. But he did not admit his guilt. And the third time, he was again called. And then the door opened, and in the next room he saw his children. Then the door closed, and he heard terrific cries from behind that door. The children were screaming. He knew that they were tortured. When he came back, he told his friend he didn't speak for 24 hours. And then when he came to his mind, he told his friend, he said, I admitted everything. I said I was guilty of sabotage. I signed all the papers they told me to sign. But he said, when I will be dead, when they will shoot me, tell my children that I never committed any crime against my people. He was shot. Those people, the type of people I'm speaking about, the Russian old intellectuals mostly, there is no more aristocracy in Russia. They're all done away with. None left. A few abroad. But the intellectuals, and what is worse of all, the peasants, these people who are working for the government, whom the government is exploiting, they are persecuted. They are sent to Siberia. Priests, former police, former officers, and some even party members. You never know. He has done something wrong, and when they punish a party member, he's punished even sometimes more severely than a non-party member. Nobody can escape the punishment. Everybody, every minute, can be arrested and sent to jail or to the north of Russia. Well, the Soviets have found an enormous amount of gold. That is in the Arctic, where during the whole winter, the sun never shines. It's always dark. And the ground is so frozen that only in summertime, it's just the top of the ground that is thawing a little bit. All the rest of it is ice. The winds are so severe that people, when they go out of their huts, they sometimes have to tie themselves up because they're blown off. 500,000 every year I brought to this northern camp of Russia, to Kolyma. 500,000 people. They die, they perish, others are brought over. They live in barracks, wooden barracks that they build themselves. The stoves are small iron stoves that hardly give any heat. They have no warm shoes, no coats, rags. And when they cannot work because the food is so bad and they are exhausted, the soldiers of the NVD lift them up with bayonets. And if they try to escape, they have those dog hounds, the enormous dogs that chase them and sometimes devour them on the spot. Well, these people are dying in hundreds, hundreds of thousands. And at forced labor, there is a number, I couldn't tell you exactly, but it changes between 12 to 15 million people at forced labor in Russia at the present moment. Well, I'm giving you a very dismal picture. I want to talk and tell you a few words about education. There is an idea in the United States that there was about 85% illiterate in Russia during the Tsarist regime. That's a little bit exaggerated. My figures are 45% illiterate, and this figure falls mostly towards women, because you couldn't get the girls go to school. And the boys, if they went to school, they had 1 year less in military service. So nearly all the men of Russia were literate. According to the figures, illiteracy had to be liquidated by 1928, no matter if the revolution would have broken out or not. But I must say, quite frankly and honestly, that the Soviet government has done quite a lot for education. Many more schools were opened, many more colleges, many more universities. And I have met a number of Soviet people coming now from the occupied zones of Austria and Germany. They are people who are, in our sense, they are not educated, not cultural people. But in their sphere, if it's electricity, or if it's mechanics, or engineering, or chemistry, in this field he is educated, he knows. But he will not speak about literature or music, he will not know languages. He's not educated in the wide sense. The education is somewhat at a lower level. While in old days, the education was, it was only a small group of intellectuals, but it was much higher. The level of education was much higher. And I must say here that when I was the director of the school, I saw how all the children of Russia and the young people of Russia, how they wanted to get educated. It was, I don't know what they wanted more, plenty of bread or education. And it is with them that we have to unite in one effort to win this Cold War. Not to repatriate, to bring more understanding, to make the voice of America louder, to give our friendship to those people. And I think that at the present moment, it's our last struggle. It's a question, as Shakespeare said, to be or not to be. And I believe that with the great heart and spirit of this country, we can bring help even behind the Iron Curtain with our friendship, understanding, our sympathy to those who are suffering more than anybody else in the world. Let us remember what Gandhi alone did with this great spirit that he had in him. He alone, without the UN or without the League of Nations, he alone stopped civil war in his country. And we, with the spirit of our friendship, can do more to win the war, the Cold War, than we can do with arms, airplanes, and atomic bombs. Thank you.